I'm Doris Edman, and our discussion topic today is discipline versus abuse. Although we wouldn't want to admit it, but we are all potential child abusers. No matter what economic level, professional level, parents under stress can be easily triggered into physical or verbal abuse. Child abuse experts say cases always go up when the unemployment rises, that children suffer the most when parents are under the stress of being out of work. Child abuse takes many forms. It may be physical, sexual, verbal, or a combination of all three, or it may be physical neglect, that is, lack of food, clothing, supervision, or emotional neglect, treating the child as if he or she doesn't exist, and depriving the child of human caring. If we suspect any child to be the victim of any form of abuse, we are responsible to report that case. Doctors and teachers especially, any professionals working with children, are legally responsible to report even the suspicion of child abuse. And there are over 1 million cases a year in the United States. In California, you're subject to a $500 fine and a year in jail if you don't report a child abuse case in your classroom, or if the doctor doesn't report it when a patient comes to him. Rudy and I have been working as volunteers with the California Ventura County Child Abuse and Neglect Agency called CAN. Rudy's been speaking to child development classes and parent groups and community organizations about child abuse. He uses a film and tries to answer questions on child abuse. I've been a part of the Child Advocate Program, talking to children to help them understand the stress of being a parent. And in connection with that, before I go into discussing the discipline, I'd like to read what a reporter has written about our child advocate program. I think they've been very clear in describing it. He's talking about the woman who is the coordinator of our program. I was with her that day talking to kindergartners, first and second graders. She was talking to fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. And it says, nearly 60 sixth graders listened intently as the young woman assured them that every single one of them is special and that no one has a right to hurt them or to touch their body in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable. And you need to know that if that happens to you, it's okay to tell a teacher or a principal or any other grown-up you trust, said Brenda Hunter, a social worker for the Ventura-based group, Child Abuse and Neglect, CAN. She told the students that child abuse is something everyone that needs to know more about. If we don't know what it is, we won't know what to do about it, she says. And it doesn't matter whether you are a kindergartner or a senior citizen. You can do something about child abuse. And that's the idea that Hunter and her 5-year-old nonprofit organization are trying to impart to both children and adults throughout Ventura County. Hunter stressed that theirs is a preventive program. Most agencies are set up to deal with abuse after it takes place, but CAN provides intervention and prevention and tries to identify and help treat abusers before they take their problems out on their children, she explained. The goal is not to punish, but to identify the child in danger, to determine if child abuse is present, to stop the abuse and to protect the child. We also offer treatment and wherever possible try to strengthen the family. Ours is really a positive program, and we always stress the difference between abuse and discipline and make sure they understand there is a difference. Hunter said in an interview and explained to the students that child abuse occurs when a child is seriously injured by an adult. We're not talking about discipline, whether we like it or not. Discipline is good for us. It serves a purpose, she told the children assembled around her. If we don't do our jobs, we deserve discipline. It teaches us how to get along with other people and be responsible. And there's a big difference between serious injury and discipline, she stressed. If you come home from school and your mother is on the phone, don't interrupt her and make her mad. If you need to ask a question, write it down and make a yes or no box for her to check, Hunter said. She advised them if their parents are discussing something or paying bills or deep in thought, not to barge in and interrupt. Say, excuse me, do you have a minute for me? Chances are they will be so shocked they will listen, she said, as the students laughed. She said if they see that their father is unhappy or sad, they should ask if there is something they can do to help, to try to cheer him up. If that doesn't work, sometimes it's very, very wise for you to find something else to do. Go to your room or outside and play. Be smart. Protect yourself, she said. Be invisible for a while and find something else to do. When I talk to the kindergartners and the first and second graders, I have a little puppet that sings a song about making yourself invisible. She advised the group to compliment their parents and let them know how appreciative they are when they are driven to soccer practice or to the movies or Disneyland. If you'll follow these suggestions and think about what stress your parents are under, you can keep from triggering abuse, Hunter told them. Parents under stress can be triggered into verbal or physical abuse if you approach them at the wrong time or get in the way. Hunter told an interviewer that more than 1 million American children are abused or neglected yearly. Of that number, up to 200,000 are physically abused, 100,000 are sexually abused, and the rest are neglected or emotionally abused. 2,000 or more children die each year because of abuse or neglect, Hunter said. About 84% of juvenile delinquents report a previous history of child abuse and neglect. I hope, do any of you have this kind of a program in your town? I hope that some of you will try to start it, because if we don't stop the abuse that is going on right now, I just don't know what's going to happen to these children when they become adults. Because we know that children who have been abused will be abusing parents. That's a fact. And I think our churches need to do something positive in this area. No, this is just a state or a county organization, actually. But there are similar types of organizations throughout the country that follow this pattern.
Where does that come from? Do they go to schools?
Yeah, we go into schools when we're invited. Right now, Thousand Oaks, where I live, is on, that's the town we're concentrating on right now. And Mrs. Hunter goes into the school to the principal's meetings at the beginning of the year and tells them what we are willing to do. And Ask them to call the CAN office when they are would like to have us come. So we usually spend one day in each school, and we go in teams of threes, each one talking to a group that we feel most comfortable with. And since I've been an early childhood teacher for last 15 years, that is the group that I feel most comfortable with. And they're happy because they feel that they just can't connect with the little child. They'd much rather talk to children that they've been used to working with. Now we'll talk a little bit here about discipline. It comes from the word disciple, and it means one who learns from another or is being taught. Discipline is designed to help the child into adulthood. Abuse, on the other hand, does not take the child's future needs into consideration. It is not designed to help the child learn socially acceptable ways of expressing natural desires and drives. Abuse dumps an adult's feelings on the child in a harmful or neglectful way. It is punishment. Discipline is not punishment. Discipline is not shame, and it's not guilt, but it helps the child to think and to learn that his present and future behavior, so that his present and future behavior is changed. Discipline helps a child to grow intellectually and emotionally. It enhances his self-confidence and self-image, the thing we talked about yesterday in here. And it's best taught by example. Discipline helps a child learn a lesson that will carry over and affect positively future behavior. Abuse had the opposite effect. It affects a child's future behavior in ways that are increasingly less desirable to the parents. Abuse leads to anger, more hatred, more deviant activity, which in later life are frequently vented against society. Most prisoners were abused as children. They're venting their anger with their parents as youngsters against society now. You have to take it out on somebody. Discipline enhances the child's sense of self-worth. It helps a child learn self-control, a quality he can take pride in. Discipline helps a child fit into the family and society in a comfortable way, which leads him to conclude that he is basically good, strong, and an effective person. One form of abuse that is often overlooked is shaming the child. Shame is designed to destroy the child's self-image. It is designed to make the child believe that there's something wrong with him, that somehow he is evil, defective, no good, or worthless. To attempt to control the child's behavior through shame may work when the adult is present and watching, but it'll not carry over to future behavior of the child. It will not help the child grow in self-discipline. Guilt is similar to shame, but is carried with the child longer and penetrates deeper into his emotional life. Shame is a technique commonly used on children up to the ages of 4 or 5, at which time it is replaced by guilt. At that point, guilt becomes synonymous with the voice of conscience. When the mother leaves the house saying, "Don't take any cookies," the voice forbidding the cookies remains in the child's mind. If the relationship between the parent and the child is good, that voice has enough power to influence the child's behavior. And that's good. We need to build a conscience. But you can't build a conscience if the child is hating the person who is correcting him. There has to be a good, loving relationship between the two. So the child will want to please the person who is helping to teach him. If she takes on the child feels an internal sense of conflict if she is being shamed and discomfort because she knows that she's done something wrong. Abuse often takes the form of instilling unwarranted feelings of guilt about their feelings and thoughts. They are also made to feel guilty about things that they have not done, or to feel responsible for things that they are not responsible for. These emotionally abusive techniques are destructive to the self-image of any child. Many times a child feels guilty when his parents are divorced. They feel that it's their fault, and they take this responsibility upon themselves. Unless the parents are very careful to explain to them that it wasn't their fault and they had nothing to do with the separation. There's one kind of abuse that sometimes I'm afraid parents don't think of it as abuse, and that's shaking a child. Now, this is very dangerous. Children have been brain damaged by too severe shaking. And sometimes we think of that as sort of a harmless way to discipline, just giving the child a good shake. I suppose a little shake isn't going to do any damage, but if a parent is angry, he's often carried away by excessive punishment. Now, abuse satisfies the need of the parent. It only helps children think in terms of pain and hatred and revenge and hostility. Abuse helps them learn how to plot ways of getting even and ways of avoiding future abuse, even if this means lying, running away, or other forms of avoiding responsibility. Abuse also helps penetrate parents' sense of inadequacy as people. Discipline, on the other hand, teaches children to use their own resources in the future rather than to depend on their parents. Discipline helps children grow. It neither stunts their growth nor destroys their self-confidence. Ultimately, the reason older children do the right thing is that they don't like themselves as well if they do the wrong thing. Discipline helps develop a sense of self-worth, the most important ingredient necessary for a child's positive behavior in the future. So whenever we see our child doing right things, then he needs affirmation. That's when we should give him the attention. Discipline is best taught by example, but so is abuse. The vast majority of abusive parents were themselves abused as children, and abusive parenting behavior is handed down from one generation to the next. The examples of behavior you set are the lessons your child is learning, not through your words, not through your intent, but through what your child sees you do. Now, Mrs. Hunter, I observed Mrs. Hunter in one of her presentations before I entered the program and was trained, and she was telling the group, and this was a group of high school students, that she herself was abused. And she said, she had an 11-month-old baby, and the baby started crying, and she said She didn't know what to do to stop her. She said, I was ready to throw the baby against the wall. And we know that this has happened time and again. Parents throwing their babies against the wall just to keep them quiet and killing them. It's just almost impossible to imagine the number of young children who are killed because they cry too much. And she said, I should finish that story. She said she was ready to throw her baby against the wall, and then her husband walked in, and so she said she just handed the baby to her husband and said, I've got to get out of here. So she just went for a walk. But it was things like that that got her into the child abuse program. And many of the workers in child abuse are people who were abused and realize how important it is to stop this cycle. Discipline is not a simple process. If it were, children would just follow instructions. If children were simply creatures of instinct, there would be little need for parenting discussions. But children are not simple, and understanding them is the only reasonable basis for discipline. Understanding means taking into consideration the many processes all operating at the same time that contribute to the child's development. Successful discipline is geared to the child's developmental stage, one of the important goals of self-discipline. The basic reason that children begin to learn to discipline themselves is to please adults. Early on, they learn that it's nice to be liked. Babies respond to all the positive talk. You're such a sweet baby. You're such a wonderful child. And comments, and I love you so much. These comments that the parents put out, the babies don't understand the words, but they certainly understand the emotion behind them. And the nice feeling they get from hearing these words. Likewise, although babies don't understand negative words, they'll withdraw or cry in the face of negative statements. To affect positive behavior change in a baby, parents must express positive feelings. It's also essential to realize that children can respond to your desires only when they are physically mature enough to do so. To place expectations on babies before they are developed enough to handle those expectations will only lead to frustration, regression, or even mental illness. If you try to teach a baby something like toilet training before he's ready, it will produce frustration, anger, disappointment, and very confused and regressed child. Expecting babies or children of any age to perform something that they are not ready for will set in motion a discipline style fraught with failure, anger, and unhappiness. From the age of 2 up, until age 9 or 10, children are especially sensitive to the actions of adults. The feelings of children at this age range are easily hurt. Children are sensitive to not only to your love, but also to your anger, disappointment, and criticism. Young children seldom need harsh words, and they need punishment, painful punishment, less often than that. As they grow older, children gradually understand explanations, and words become an important aspect of discipline. But what do you suppose is the age when the most children are severely abused? What would be your guess? What is the most frustrating age in a child?
Two.
Yes. And it's known as the most abused age. The parents take the child's negativism, which is natural, they take it personally rather than objectively, saying, well, he's that age, you know, we're going to have to put up with him that way for a while. At this age, children also do a great deal of testing, and parents see red. You're not going to get by with this. We're going to see who's boss around here. And they will like to test the parents and find out, do they really mean what they're saying to me now? And they are going through a stage where they're becoming independent as much as possible of their parents. Young children do not learn quickly from experiences intended to limit their behavior. They may test the electrical outlets many times before they accept the fact that they're not to play with them. Early childhood is not the time for lengthy explanations. They won't work. Instead, continue your gentle and persuasive firmness. Take pleasure and pride in knowing that your child is getting a little older and a little more independent and is beginning to develop a mind of his own. I think we should worry about a two-year-old who doesn't become very negative and no-oriented. These can all be positive experiences, and this is a time when positives particularly need to be kept in mind. We need to watch the moment for readiness for each developmental task as the child matures. Sometimes it's difficult to wait for the signal, especially when the child next door is the same age as your child and is walking and your child is still crawling. So many parents feel that their prestige is at stake. 10 years in the future, no one will be able to tell who walked first, or who talked first, or who was potty trained first, or even who read first. I often got the question when people called my lab school. I had the lab school at Augustana College for 6.5 years, and we had four-year-olds, and many times the parent would call and say, well, now, do you teach them to read? And I tried to explain to them that children are learning to read from the time they're born and hearing sounds and beginning to distinguish sounds. It's all part of the reading process, and it's much more important that they learn the meaning of words than it is to be able to recognize them on the written page. And if they learn to read at four, fine. If they want to, if they're asking to, if they start to on their own, but to set them down and try to teach them to read at four, to me that's a form of child abuse. One little child whose mother just kept pushing him and pushing him, wanting him to tie his shoes before he was ready, to read before he was ready, do all the things that maybe it was a cousin who was prompting all this, who was probably just a little bit ahead of her child. Finally, the child just stopped and said, "Let me be as I grow." And I think that is one of the best advice that anyone can give a person. I heard that from our counselor when I was we were in Oklahoma City when our children were born, and I belonged to a an AAUW mothers group, and we were fortunate to have an elderly woman who had specialized in early childhood education to be our mentor. And she told us that story, and fortunately I heard it while it still could do me some good with my own children, because they were all still preschoolers. But I kept that as a watchword all along when they were growing up. Am I letting them be as they grow? When they are ready for something, the learning will be fun and not frustrating. You can actually slow the learning process and doom the child to failure when you don't stick to the principle of a developmental task. That's the task he happens to be ready for at that moment. And when they do reach that point of learning readiness, they learn with joy. It's an extremely delightful experience. I remember little Ian, who came to school one day, and he said, "Mrs. Edmund, today I'm going to learn to lace and tie my shoes." And I said, "Well, Ian, that's great. Let's see who can help you." And there was a little girl there who had learned to lace and tie her shoes, so she agreed to help Ian. And they sat over in the corner, I don't know how long they were. Some people, psychologists, call this a learning tick, when they are willing to repeat and repeat and try over and over and over again. Well, Ian was on a learning kick that day. Sometimes there's another a word they use for it. They say it's the activity that consolidates learning. And before the morning was over, Ian knew how to lace and tie his shoes, because he was ready. If somebody tried to teach him last week, he would have been just frustrated and probably never wanted to try to learn to tie his shoes. You can remember when you were small, some of the things that you learned. You learned to play jacks, you learned to walk on stilts, you learned to skate. When you were ready, and then you were willing to spend a day out there trying to get those stilts to work, or those roller skates to go, and or the jacks. I was the youngest child in the family, so I was kind of left by myself to play a lot of times by myself. And I remember the skills I would decide today, this is what I'm going to take up. Same thing with riding a bicycle. Then it's an experience of joy when we can do it on our own. I know we have a, well, he was 11 at the time, grandson, who was determined to play the piano. They didn't have a piano, but he just kept begging and begging to learn to play the piano. Well, they finally got one for him. And his mother said he couldn't walk by that piano but without sitting down and practicing. And before the year was up, he was playing Bach, Mozart, all kinds of difficult pieces, because he was on this learning kick, and as far as I know, he's still on that learning kick. But if anybody had tried to tell him he ought to learn to play the piano when he was 8, he probably would have said, "Oh no, not me." But we need to watch for that time, and then they make up all the time they lost when they really want to do it. I wonder if any of you can remember early experiences, or even with your own children, that bear out this philosophy of learning when you're ready.
I know that potty training thing.
The potty training, okay.
She was 2 and a half and did it in a week, and I had people who said she should have been trained by the time she was 2.
Well, you were very, very wise not to listen to people who
Who said that? Because...
Oh, people, well, me, I think they were well-meaning, but they just said she should be, and she's the bedwetter at 6, and we don't make any big deal of it, but...
Well, people, they've found out that this bedwetting thing is a physical thing. It's, I know a lot of parents carry a lot of guilt around thinking that their child has been emotionally frustrated or something because they're still bedwetting when they're 8 years old and should be going to camp, and it's all very embarrassing. But it's a physical thing.
Yeah, but really well, she just takes the diaper.
Sure.
But I have to watch the people who are really
offended.
Going to put her down.
Yeah.
Right.
So
we just
deploy
in the
business. I'd like to raise a question, if you permit. Yeah. When you hit on a piano example, it really hit home for us because we've been just going through that with our 10-year-old daughter who has been taking lessons for 3 years and doesn't want to anymore. And we also have a 12-year-old daughter who's been taking us for 6 years and loves every bit of it.
Right.
I guess the question that would come to my mind is, how do you, I'm reflecting as a parent now.
Sure.
As you think about your child and your expectations for your child, what's a good rule of thumb between looking at your expectations for the child and their potential and their possibilities that you see and that the teachers have told you they're there, and maybe their reluctance to take hold of some of their possibilities, maybe not being motivated to move ahead like in school or to, I guess the tension sometimes becomes between pressurizing your kid to do what they are capable of doing and they have potential and gifts in doing, and their reluctance to go ahead sometimes to do that. You just keep waiting until they are ready to do what they are capable of doing?
Try to find out what they would like to do. For instance, if she's letting her piano go now, maybe she would like to learn to play the flute. Try another instrument. She has the background. She knows the keyboard. And she may really take off on the flute. But let her decide. Take her to some concerts. Provide an environment that might encourage her to learn to play another instrument. I know with my grandson, they have been taking him to concerts for a long time. And I really feel that he admired somebody who gave a piano concert and gave him the idea this is what he wanted. He's always wanted to play the drums, but they didn't think that they could tolerate that, and they were thrilled when he brought up the idea of playing the piano. And they're both percussion instruments. He needed something to take care of his frustrations, and a percussion instrument is that very kind, that you can play the piano when you're mad and really feel good after you get through playing. Scott Joplin stuff that they played this morning, he loves Scott Joplin, and he will play until I want to hold my ears, but he's loving it and he's getting something out of it, and I feel he's growing and developing. It's tough. I had three daughters, and none of them really did much with the piano. They all took piano. They enjoyed it, but none of them became great on the piano. But they all learned enough so that they went back and worked on it more after they became adults. And one daughter even taught her husband how to play the piano after they were married. You'd be amazed how these things pop up later in life, when they'll pick it up, maybe when they retired. I know people who have started taking piano lessons after they've retired. Yes?
We found kind of the same thing that you're expressing with our daughters too. I felt that, well, I'd like them to play an instrument. So we gave them both piano lessons, And then, well, you're going to practice every day. And then we started subtracting 5 cents for the days that they missed. You know, and it became where we realized the piano just wasn't the thing to do. Piano lessons, per se. And then one of my daughters from peer pressure, she wanted to be included, decided she'd try to play the flute, and found out this she wasn't getting the immediate gratification of, I'm able to play the flute. Good. Easy, quick. So she quit that one. We have a difficult time with our oldest daughter because that's her thing in life. She wants to be, have something that she's good at right now.
Yeah.
You know, and the best, she has to work at it. We're again told that she's got great capabilities, but you push her and she moves slower. And she only gives enough to get by and then that's it.
Yeah.
But with my piano lessons, I took them for a little while I was young, and it was a real pain in the rear. And then I found later on, I sat down, I started to play myself and teach myself, and I thought, well, now maybe's the time for some lessons. And I found for myself, then I had to do it. It wasn't a sit down and enjoy and learn at my own pace, and it was a, you must do it. And I found for myself, I think I learned better on my own.
Yeah.
You know,
no pressure.
No pressure. Mm-hmm. No pressure to be anything or to have such and such done by this time. But that if I paint, I do better on my own. Slower maybe, but happier.
Yeah. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm changing the subject, but
sure.
Motivation in that. Same daughter, 10-year-old. the potential is there, but in school, how do you motivate when they've got it and you know they do? How do you motivate it to do their potential, or more than getting by?
Yeah.
You know, flopping through it and getting it done as fast as they can so they can get on something else. How do you motivate to do a good job and do it their potential?
Yeah. Huh?
Are both your girls in the same school?
No, not anymore.
Oh, because I had a sister who was younger than me, but brighter, and it wasn't until we got into a very large high school that I could do my own thing.
Yeah.
Without carrying her on my back. People say, one teacher said in the fourth grade, and I'll never forget this, I do not see how you could be related to her. You know, because I wasn't as bright.
Yeah, well, that's bad.
So, in defiance to that teacher, I thought, well, you think I'm dumb, let me show you what I can do. And so I took and turned all the papers so the margin was on the other side and the papers, you know, the holes all came out on the other side. And I turned a whole theme book, you know, that we worked on, I turned it in that way. And of course, you know, she just went through the ceiling and I just clapped for joy.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't until I got away from Wendy and, you know, you go do your thing in this super huge high school, I'm going to hide out in my own place. And I really resent parents who compare because boy, you can load it. One of them up with something like, you think I'm done? Let me sit here for a while.
That's, we talked about that in great length yesterday and building a self-image. But similar to that idea, I have twin granddaughters who are 15, and one of them is super ambitious, you know. I don't think there's any difference between the IQ of the two of them. I don't know what it is, but I really don't think that there's a difference. But the one is so aggressive. I mean, she wants to be the best. She takes all the top-level courses. And the other one's just laid back. She said, well, I don't know why I should be taking the top-level courses. They put her in another school. They have, fortunately, in the cities in Irvine, California, they have different schools, and the bus that'll take them to whatever school they want to go. So she started going to this other school and making her own friends. Before, she was just kind of a tag-along with the other one and her friends, and she just didn't feel she fit. Now she is one of the happiest kids. You know, we just see the difference when she comes to visit for the weekend. She's full of smiles. Before, she was just like, boy, somebody was beating her down because she could not get up to her. Well, she didn't want to get up to her sister's potential. Yes.
You know, sometimes I feel really, something that I really noticed not all that long ago, and I'm sorry that I didn't. But my husband and I were first children of four children, and I was to be the example, and he was a PK, So, you know, he had to be an example. And so we're, you know, kind of perfectionist oriented within ourselves. I didn't want to crap down to my kids at all. But my oldest, but we're more quiet, more easy, well, I won't say easygoing, but not just really need a lot of activity sort of people.
Yeah.
And my oldest daughter is aggressive, and I would want to read her or hold her or whatever else. She wanted to get down, she wanted to go.
Yeah.
And my second child, Miss Femininity.
Snuggles.
Snuggles, the whole bit. She fits in. And I didn't realize till recently, my oldest daughter has never been a complying child. The second one is. So sometimes I'm afraid now what I see is, you know, I realize how uncomfortable my oldest daughter is, but I realize too that how much we bend over backwards to make that oldest one have everything or to get all that that she needs. And sometimes I'm afraid that the little one, well, I don't know, she's like the easygoing, you know, she fits in and, you know, sometimes I'm worried she's going to be left out. But I really didn't realize how out of it that oldest one feels compared to the three of us who have more temperaments, more alike.
Yeah, that's true. I'm glad you're sensitive to this, because you can do things to modify it.